The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. And thank you all for coming. My name is Daniel Fife. I'm a member of the George S. Pepper Society. I'm a big fan of acclaimed food author Mark Bittman. He is the author of the Minimalist column in the New York Times and of multiple James Beard Award and IACP Julia Child Award winning cookbooks, including the iconic and influential How to Cook Everything, which has sold more than a million copies since publication. Bittman's latest cookbook is a follow-up to his New York Times bestseller, Food Matters, A Guide to Conscious Eating, offering recipes that are both healthier for you and for the environment. Practical and balanced, praises Publishers Weekly. This collection will shape the way we cook at home for years to come. Ladies and gentlemen, it is quite an honor to have him here tonight. Please join me in welcoming the inventive and insightful Mark Bittman.
Moi? How's the sound? Sounds good here. I'm not going to talk so much about cooking. I'm not going to talk about how I became a food writer. I'm not going to talk about the New York Times. I'm going to talk about eating and food. Maybe we'll start by, maybe if you've experienced a time in your life when you couldn't take cheap and plentiful food for granted, could you just raise your hand? Couldn't. Right. I'm expecting very few of you, those of you who are hesitating. So I counted three or four, which is seems about right, 1%. Few of us have had that experience. There are poor people, of course, and there are people old enough to remember the Depression, and then there are immigrants from countries where hunger is endemic. But most of us, the majority of Americans, have never known a day or even a meal without the availability of an incredible array of unrealistically inexpensive food. We, Americans, spend less money on food than anyone in the world, about 7% of our income. In much of Europe, it's around 10%, but in those countries where we think of food as being good, France and Italy and Japan, for example, it's more like 15%. But in most of the world's poor countries, ranging from Guatemala to Egypt to Ukraine, India, and China, it can be as high as 40%. This is changing for everyone. The real costs of food are starting to show up, and they're staggering. No one knows what a hamburger really costs. I've seen estimates as high as $200. It certainly doesn't cost 99 cents. The price you pay is the tip of the iceberg. The costs to the environment and to your health are far greater. Until now, of course, those costs have been hidden or subsidized, but they're appearing in the form of global warming, water and land shortages, environmental damage, as well as in the form of lifestyle diseases, which for the first time in history now kill more people than communicable diseases. The bottom line is this. We can no longer sustain an American-style diet, let alone an American-style life. And I would define the typical death-defying American diet as an underconsumption of unprocessed plants and an overconsumption of industrially produced livestock, processed food in general, junk food in particular. Now, there's some overlap here. You can take a chicken that's industrially produced, and you can process it, and it turns into junk food. Chicken McNugget is a perfect example, but you can probably have some fun thinking up some of these yourself. When I first started giving this talk, which was actually right after the last time I was in Philadelphia, I did have a slide, which I still do, of this beautiful cow and this horrific mushroom cloud. And it's a little hyperbolic. You got to get people to pay attention. But I do believe that that never before in recorded history has planetary health and individual health been so tied together. Scary as things have been, scary as they were when I started giving this talk 18 or 24 months ago, I think they've gotten worse in a faster way than I or almost anyone else could have predicted. Now, we're not evil, at least most of us are not evil, but we have been naive. We weren't made aware of the limited nature of energy. And, of course, in the United States, there are entire energies whose lifeblood is encouraging us to buy everything we can, regardless of their consequences. Even the government now seems to believe that the only way we can prosper is to have each of us buy as much as we can at the cost of sucking the earth dry. It's not surprising that we have led the charge in the American way of life. We're the world's most environmentally damaging country. Our per capita emissions, for example, are three times the size they are in Denmark. These are old statistics, but they remain shocking, I think. We make up 4% of the world's population, we use about a quarter of the energy, and we produce about 25% of its carbon dioxide emissions, which is more than China, India, and Japan combined. Our record in food is almost as bad. We consume something between 15 and 20% of the world's meat. We have big houses, central air conditioning, huge refrigerators, hair dryers, dry cleaners, multiple everythings, two TVs, six TVs, two cars, three cars. We heat and cool every room in the house, even if we're not using them. And in the winter, they're warm enough to walk around in shorts, and in the summer, cool enough to walk around in a sweater. Now, this is what I call, this is my great contribution to economics and science. I'll be remembered for this. This is the, we'll see if the laser pointer works too. Look at that. This is the Bittman bell curve of bad habits. On top, we have good habits, bicycles and broccoli. You understand these are symbolic. On the bottom, we have bad habits, SUVs and steak. Is it? What is it? And this is the bell curve of bad habits. Now, my feeling is this. We Americans have moved really, really far in the direction of bad habits. And I actually like to think we're about here right now. We've actually come up a little bit. We're moving in the right direction now. I'm an optimist. But my feeling is also that it's possible that the rest of the world, which is more in touch with its traditional ways, won't sink quite as low as we have before turning upwards. So that, as I said, that's my contribution. What can I tell you? However, the pessimistic side of me says, our way of life does remain enviable to the peasant-turned-factory worker in China or India, a person who sees a world of clothes dryers, of one automobile per person, of more televisions and telephones than people, of supermarkets where a pound of meat costs what the average American earns in minutes, but for which the average citizen of China, for example, might work half a day. We were, as I said, naive, but naivete no longer excuses us. We have new disclaimers now. The Chinese will screw up the world if we don't. My husband wants to eat meat every day for dinner. We need two cars to get to work. My wife feels safer in her SUV. I don't feel full when I don't eat meat. Or the famous all-encompassing, I'm too busy. Too busy to hang clothes on the line, too busy to take public transportation, too busy to recycle, certainly too busy to cook, and sadly and evidently too busy to think or to act. Let's define sustainability. Sustainability is the capacity to endure. We endure for our lifespans. But our personal sustainability is now challenged not only by age or accident or other things we take for granted, but by our lifestyles and now, incredibly, by the Earth's own capacity to endure. Almost certainly our children, if not ourselves, will see shortages that 20 years ago were unimaginable, shortages that are now discussed openly and frequently. In 2008, and you will remember this, Food reached its highest per capita cost since the mid-19th century. There are food riots in 30 countries, from India to Cameroon to Haiti. Rice prices were up 150%. Thieves were stripping rice paddies, and Walmart rationed rice sales. That is a real slide. That was a warning shot. Food output, which once grew at the rate of 10% a year through most of our lifetimes, is now growing at the rate of 1% a year. Now, why is this? Because every resource on Earth, water, land, nutrients, all forms of energy, fish, other animals, has been mined, continues to be mined. This is the drill, baby, drill mentality. Mined as if it were limitless. Mined as if we were back in the 50s, prosperous, naive, in an America with unlimited possibilities. If the rest of the world could tag along, well, wouldn't that be nice? But if it couldn't, there was a saying in World War II, "Screw you, Jack, I got mine." The world is now one. Borders don't matter much. The weather is getting more extreme. Population is growing. Production is slowing. And resources are dwindling. Let's look at a few resources. Talk about water for a second. 70% of water is devoted to agriculture. And there'll be more competition for that water as the population grows. The average calorie of food takes a liter of water to produce. But it takes 10 times as much water to produce beef as it does to produce grain, and at least 15 times as much to produce beef as it does most vegetables. The water needed to produce more meat does not exist, and yet if we were to produce less meat, we could produce and deliver more food. The story with land is quite similar. These percentages here should be acres. Where you see a percent sign, read acres. The world's farmed area has remained about the same for the last 20 years. There's just not that much left. Yet in that time, population has increased by 23% and per capita consumption has increased by nearly 4%. The average earthling requires 4.4 acres of land and sea for their needs. The average American requires 22 acres of land and sea, four times as much. One reason is that it takes around 10 times as much land to raise meat as it does to raise plants. How about fertilizer? Some elements of fertilizer are mined, and others are made from natural gas. Half the chemical fertilizer we apply is washed away, and we use seven times as much as we did half a century ago. We're using phosphorus three times as quickly as the Earth can generate it. If demand were to remain steady, which it will not, there's a century's worth of phosphorus left in the earth, maybe 50 years of nitrogen. We can't produce more than we're producing now. Demand is increasing, and what we're producing now is not sustainable. This can't endure. When the amount of resources we use exceeds the amount the earth can generate, regenerate, the amount that's sustainable, that's called overshoot. Our overshoot now is about 33%. Which means it takes the Earth 16 months to regenerate what we consume in a year. Another way to look at it is that if we had 1 1/3 Earths, we could be living a sustainable life. At the current rate of growth, though, our overshoot's going to be 100% by 2050, which means we'd need 2 Earths in order to become sustainable. And by now you're not surprised to learn that if we were to all live like Americans, we'd need 4 Earths. By assuming unlimited supplies, by acting as if our actions have no consequences, we're part of a chain of events that has the potential to become the Earth's 6th mass extinction. This is not hyperbole. What to do? What to do? The American diet is hardly the only problem, but it's one we can address. We don't need to do agriculture on Mars. We don't need to find a new wondrous source of fuel. We don't even need to build a new transit system to begin to eat less meat and junk and more plants. And changing our diet helps solve many other problems. Yet, again, the pessimistic part of me thinks maybe our diet is inexorable. Given a chance, it seems almost everyone wants to eat meat. But even if we could double our meat supply to account for the demands of increased population and the desire of others to eat like us. Even if everybody on Earth could eat better, the problem here is that better means worse. So in a way, we're lucky we can't meet that demand. Now, the problem with almost everything I'm discussing here, sort of aside from what a problem it is that it's intangible to many people. We say, hey, food is priced at a fraction of its real cost. We have to think of the food system as global. We have to acknowledge that food's priced at a fraction of its real cost. We have to acknowledge that food is beginning to kill us and to strangle our planet. To most Americans, little of this registers. We can still go to the supermarket and buy, quite literally, 200 pounds of meat for the price of an average weekly salary. We know that many lifestyle diseases result from the American diet. We know that if you eat more plants and less of everything else, you'll live a longer and healthier life. Your ecological footprint will shrink. We don't need animal products or white bread or Coke. No one is born craving Skittles or Whoppers or donuts. The demand for these things is driven by marketing, and that marketing has been supported by industry-friendly government. Now, how this happened is a long story. I'm going to try to get through it in 1 minute. 100 years ago, everyone was a locavore. Even in New York had pig farms nearby. Shipping food long distances was a ridiculous notion, and every family had a cook, usually a mom. We ate real food, and goldfish still swam. Then we built railroads and later an interstate system. We irrigated California, and we invented refrigeration. All of this created surpluses of food in some places and the ability to move it to and store it in others. We began processing natural food into odd things that could be shipped and stored easily. Meat, after all, is a convenient way to convert grain to protein and fat. Plants, I will say in an aside as I turn the page. Plants are the source of all food. Only plants can actually create food from ingredients that exist in nature. Earth, soil, air, sun. Sorry, earth, soil, water, sun. Plants create food out of those things, and then we are capable of taking the plants and processing them. Meat is processed food, wine and beer are processed foods, pasta and bread are processed foods. So there's a level on which we have unprocessed, which basically means the kind of plants that grow and that look like what they were when they were growing, and everything else. We'll get to that. Between 1950 and 2000, the world's population doubled. Meat consumption increased fivefold. Along the way, we killed family farms and real communities. We moved women into the workforce to allow people to keep consuming, and we created more demand for convenience. We began to raise animals as if they were widgets, and we subsidized this production. This made bad food cheap, so we could spend more money on things we didn't really need. Here, then, is where we are, with home cooking and real food nearly dead. And we're not doing too well, either, because we specialize in eating the things that kill us. You could not invent a worse diet than this if you tried. And that's how we eat. So once again, what do we do? Is organic food the answer? Well, in part it is. We need large-scale production. I'm convinced of that. But we need it to become sustainable, and organic techniques can help us do that. Is local food the answer? This, by the way, is a rooftop garden in Brooklyn. Is local food the answer? Partly. It makes sense to ship food in some cases. We all want olive oil. We couldn't live without coffee, right? But a far higher proportion of food can be grown within an easy day's drive of this country's population centers. Some of the work that I'm doing these days is trying to look at the area from New Jersey to the Carolinas, and then a couple hundred miles west as a sort of local regional ecosystem and what kind of food we can expect this system to produce. Wasn't New Jersey once the Garden State? I think so. The key thing we need to do is to turn around the overproduction and overconsumption of meat and junk food. We process 10 billion animals a year in this country alone. If you strung all of them, chickens and cows and pigs, if you could put them end to end, they'd go to the moon and back 5 times. That's just the U.S. The global number is 60 billion, which is unsustainable enough, as we saw with the overshoot slides. But it's projected to be 120 billion in 40 years. That's why we'd need 4 planets. So like it or not, we will reduce our meat intake. The question is, can we do it soon enough to have a positive impact, or will it take some kind of unforeseen disaster of unprecedented proportions? Most people haven't changed their diets and evidently will not. If a close relative gets fat, gets diabetes, has a heart attack, drops dead, you'll probably change your diet, but your neighbor won't. We like meat. Your neighbor will say, yeah, but I like meat. And besides, I need its nutrients, an argument that has been shot so full of holes that I'm not even going to bother to address it here. And besides, I'm not pitching veganism. I'm pitching what I call less meatarianism. I just can't come up with a better word. I'm pitching sane eating, which doesn't, not that descriptive either. I'm pitching sustainability. Yet most of us continue to eat 0.5 pound of meat a day. Now, experts in disease reduction recommend that we eat 0.5 pound of meat a week, 15% of what we're eating now. And I think that that's too drastic a reduction to suggest, because that's a very difficult change to make. But let's propose that in the interests of personal and human health, Americans were to eat 50% less meat. Like that. How does that happen? Well, if you believe me and you read my books, it's easy. You eat less meat, you eat less junk, you eat more plants, you eat more real food. It's a simple formula. Unfortunately, it's not a formula, as I said before, that everybody can hear. Often, I preach to the choir. The question is, how are we going to reach the congregation? Some people, as I said, will be convinced by the illness of a loved one. Some might be convinced by talk. If you reject whale meat, we might say, why are you eating other unsustainable foods? If you're avoiding saturated fat, you're avoiding sugar, why are you eating antibiotics? Why are you eating sugar? Why are you eating high fructose corn syrup? You changed your light bulbs. Why not eat a freaking salad? The problem is, I suspect, and you can tell that I'm a little bipolar about this, rapidly swinging from optimist to pessimist, I suspect that willing converts are going to remain the vast minority. Most Americans continue to eat badly. We like processed food. We like junk food. We choose convenience and quantity over quality. The number of salads we eat in the last 10 years as main courses has actually declined by 10%. And less than 1 in 4 meals includes an unprocessed vegetable. And the people who did that study counted lettuce on a cheeseburger as an unprocessed vegetable. Seriously. We have to find a way not only to provide decent food for everyone, but to encourage them to eat it, to promote carrots over Cheetos, to promote beans and rice over burgers and fries. Otherwise, almost everyone in America will be overweight or obese by 2050. At the current rate of growth, the death rate from obesity will surpass that of lung cancer in just 10 years. Which brings me to an interesting point. It was anti-tobacco legislation and the anti-smoking movement that gives us a compelling model. There are tens of millions fewer smokers than there would have been without federally funded and local anti-smoking campaigns. If we were that successful in cutting obesity rates, we'd save tens of millions of lives in 21st century in America alone, and we'd set an example for the rest of the world to follow. And we should start with soda. As we know, you in Philly almost did it. As cigarettes are nicotine delivery systems, soda is a sugar delivery system, legally marketed and sold without restriction to children, given to them by their parents, dispensed in schools. Yet soda is a public health menace that contributes to more deaths than AIDS, the flu, murders, or car accidents. Let's go back and compare soda and cigarettes again. They're both harmful, they're wasteful, they're worse than useless, and so their sales depend on marketing budgets in the hundreds of millions, yet they're very profitable. Coke made $7 billion in 2008. Philip Morris made $6 billion. These profits are borne by taxpayers, not only because we're the suckers buying these poisons, but because we subsidize the crops that produce them, and we pay for the enormous costs to public health and the environment. The thing is, cigarettes, at least, are regulated. But a tall 5-year-old can stick a dollar in a Coke machine and receive a jolt of caffeine and sugar, the rough equivalent of a coffee, with 9 teaspoons of sugar. Actually, and if the soda is the 20-ounce size, 17 teaspoons of sugar. That's a lot of sugar. Since the 50s, our consumption of soda has multiplied 100-fold to 600 bottles per person per year. Soft drinks are more popular than water. And this doesn't include the liquid candy like Gatorade or unspeakably cynical drinks like vitamin water, which contain a third as much sugar as Coke. We drink a quart per person of sugar-sweetened beverages a day, about 300 calories worth. Not coincidentally, between the mid-70s and the mid-90s, per capita consumption of high-fructose corn syrup, which, as you know, is the near-exclusive sweetener in soft drinks, jumped from virtually nothing to 60 pounds a year, which is equal to about 200 calories per person per day. Roughly simultaneously, the weight of the average American increased over 20%. This is simple. Weight gain is deadly. Most weight gain is driven by increased fat calories. Most increased calories come from fat and sugar, and soda is the number one sugar delivery system. Decreasing our consumption of soda is efficient, smart, preventive medicine. Now, soda, of course, is not alone. There are other non-nutritive junk foods, and we call them UFOs, unidentified food-like objects. And they're everywhere. We're hardwired to eat fat, sugar, and salt, and processed food is fattier, sweeter, and saltier than it's ever been. With the world's biggest marketing budget, literally, lobbying, payoffs, subsidies, the willful ignorance of the true costs behind it, junk food is deadly cheap. We need help to combat this. If we start with a soda tax, the momentum could become unstoppable. And since the long-term goal is hardly a Big Mac, large fries, and a bottle of water, we have to move further and move to a junk food tax, a cheeseburger tax, and finally a processed food tax. This could raise literally hundreds of billions of dollars annually while discouraging the consumption of bad food and encouraging the consumption of good. I can't see a better way to move forward than this. Think about that and think that maybe, just maybe, societies that are closer to their roots than we are may see just how harmful our diet has been, especially if we ourselves acknowledge it and don't travel too far down our path. Remember the Bittman bell curve of bad habits when you start talking about this. Big food at the moment is our enemy. Like the tobacco industry of old, it hires experts to back up its specious claims. It maintains it isn't marketing to children when it is. It endorses bad science. It funds front groups, it lobbies like mad, and it claims that its new products are safer and better. It says that it understands that there's a problem, and it wants to tackle it by creating smaller portion sizes, reducing fat and sugar content, and combating world hunger. But what's it really do? It exports McDonald's, and it exports Fruit Loops. It pushes self-responsibility campaigns, which maintain that in order to drink less soda, you have to drink less soda. But meanwhile, we're going to try to sell you more soda. And if we succeed and you drink it and you get sick, tough luck. To me, this sounds like someone holding your head underwater while they're telling you not to drown. Big Food also claims that they're improving the nutritional quality of foods advertised to children, though their healthy food often involves sticking a chemical nutrient in junk. Yeah. My parents' supermarket. Healthy processed food is an oxymoron, and if you have to label something healthy, it's not. Is big food threatened by a sound diet? Let me tell you, right now, half the food eaten in the United States is either restaurant food or takeout food. Except that doesn't tell you the real story. Because if you go to the supermarket and you buy a frozen pizza, a bag of chips, a Coke, and a piece of chocolate cake, and you take that home and you prepare it, whatever that means, that's food eaten at home. That's food prepared at home. The real numbers indicate that something like 10% of our meals are cooked from scratch, and at most, 20% of our calories come from unprocessed fruits and vegetables. Big Food simply can't make as much money on a carrot as it can on carrot cake. So we've been trained to uncook. We spend 20 times as much money in restaurants as we used to. We don't teach our kids how to cook. And our mantra has become, I'm too busy to cook. But we're busy in part, at least, because we spend 40 hours a week watching television, true statistic. And increasingly, and most ironically, horribly ironically, we're watching others cook. Ladies and gentlemen, can I tell you, cooking is not a spectator sport. Big Food claims to stand for choice, of course, and choice is all American. But in an arena where most choices are destructive, we need fewer choices, not more. And for every one of us saying, eat plants, not junk, we have hundreds of millions of dollars screaming, have it your way. This system needs flipping. We need to act, and we need to do more than give lip service, not only to recycling and alternative energy sources and reducing waste and eliminating subsidies and treating farmers like the all-important people that they are, and urban gardening and cooking. We need to tax big food and its products. And as we once demonized tobacco, we need to demonize big food. We need to demonize bad food. We need to pay what food really costs. We need to reward sustainability. We need to improve education about our stewardship of the earth and of each other. And we need to change the way we eat. Obviously, these are big issues. And we need to tackle them as a society, indeed, as a planet. This, then, is my carrot and stick list, paid for initially by the soda tax, by subsequent taxes, by taxes on big food's health and planet-destroying products, and by declining costs to our health and to the environment. The estimate is that a soda tax of a penny per ounce would reduce consumption by up to 15%, raise $15 billion a year nationally, and quickly reduce public health costs by $5 billion a year. What else should we do? I now arrive at this slide, which you've been looking at wondering, what is that doing there? Let's reduce and then let's eliminate the marketing of junk to kids. In fact, let's counter it. Madison Avenue got us into this mess, and there's no one better than Madison Avenue to get us out of it. Let's remove vending machines from schools. As of 2004, vending machines were in virtually every high school in the United States. And let's allow fewer vending machines in general. Or here's a novel idea. Let's use vending machines to dispense real food. This has actually started to happen. Let's take a step backward and make sure there's free water everywhere. Let's take a look at labeling and see if we can make it honest. Let's fix the school lunch program, which right now appears to contribute to obesity rather than counter it. Let's offer good-tasting, healthier foods in schools and elsewhere. Let's provide incentives for people to eat better and disincentives for people to eat worse. Let's take care of the so-called food deserts by giving tax breaks to retailers who sell real food. Let's give tax breaks to people who buy real food. Let's give healthcare premiums reductions for people who buy real food. In short, we tax UFOs and we subsidize real food. Chocolate chip cookies, $2. Apples, a dime. A Coke, $4. Water, free. We can create jobs for cooks. We can have them help those who are unable to cook for themselves or learn to cook. And we can subsidize basic cooking equipment for low-income families. We can subsidize farmers' markets. We can build and revive indoor city markets. We can encourage direct sale by farmers, by fishermen, even hunters. We can subsidize traditional farming instead of industrial farming. The payoffs of all of this would be incredible, and we start for paying for it. We start paying for it with the soda tax. You scoff. You might scoff, and who better than you to scoff? If I were sitting in the audience, I might scoff too. Is this pie in the sky? Well, maybe. But if we can't get a measly soda tax passed, if we can't fix school lunches, if we can't help poor people eat better, then we as individuals can at least move to a plant-heavy diet. We can become nearly vegan. We can begin to eat like our grandparents or like Italian or Japanese grandparents, not like our peers, and certainly not like real Americans. We can move from getting 10% of our calories from fresh fruits and vegetables towards getting 90% of our calories from fresh fruits and vegetables. We can continue to figure out how to get people to choose carrots over Cheetos, how to get people cooking, how to waste less food, how to support recycling not only of bottles of cans but of nutrients, of water, how to think sustainably, how to get people to eat in a way that was once taken for granted, in tune with tradition and the planet's resources, that is, sanely. Nothing is infinite, not resources, not space, and not even time. 50 at the most, 100 years from now, we're all going to be eating a plant-based diet. And probably most of those plants are going to be grown using what we now call organic techniques. Most of it will be local, too. But whether the Earth looks like a garden or a post-nuclear nightmare, whether there are billions of people thriving in peace or fighting over scraps, is going to be determined by the choices we make now. I'd like to speak for another minute about my own story, which those of you who were here when I was last year heard some of. Plants are the real food. Everything else comes from plants. You feed plants to cows, they turn it into meat. It's a production factory. There's nothing wrong with that. What's wrong with the way we're eating now is that we have everything flipped, everything backwards. This talk is largely about the politics and the global implications of that problem. But each of us can have an impact on this in our own lives. It doesn't have to be that dramatic, and it doesn't have to be that difficult. We look at our diet a little bit like a seesaw, like the pizza pictures, where a huge pie has a tiny slice of spinach. We get 80 to 90% of our calories from animal products, processed food, and junk food. We get 10 to 20% of our calories from unprocessed plants. Any dietitian, any nutritionist, any food scientist who isn't in the pay of the meat business or the processed food business will tell you that our diet, for us to be as healthy as possible, needs to look like this. Now, I'm not a vegan, and I'm not, as I said, I'm not advocating veganism, although I admire vegans. And I'm well aware that to go from this to this is a staggering request. Now, part of the reason that I spend so much time talking about the politics of this issue is that in 1964, when the Surgeon General came out with his report about the effects of smoking on people's health, cigarette sales plummeted by 25% in January and February of that year. One in four Americans were smoking fewer or no cigarettes. That is, one in four smokers had stopped or cut way back. By March, guess what? Everyone was smoking again. Sales were back to normal. These changes are very difficult to make. We all know that life changes are difficult to make. It's difficult to start exercising. It's difficult to change your diet. It's difficult to change anything that you consider a bad habit. This is why I preach a kind of incrementalism. This is why I preach, for want of a better term, less meatarianism. This is why I encourage everybody to look at their diet and say, huh, it looks like this. If I make it look like this, that's progress. This is a movement. This is a movement that has to be society-wide and worldwide, but this is a movement that you can control in your own lives. And the movement is to take your personal seesaw and move it in this direction. And if you move it 10% in the course of a year, congratulations to you. That is fabulous. If you move it 50% in the course of the year, obviously that's more movement. That's great. If you become a vegan, more power to you. But what I most want to stress is that people who move in this direction a little bit find that it becomes easier to move even more in this direction, and that gradually you wind up, as I did, being completely comfortable with a diet that looks very much like this, whereas it used to look like that, and continues to move. So that's my little pitch. I'll take questions now. How are we time-wise for questions? We have 20 minutes? Okay, 15 to 20 minutes. Okay, I will tell you this. Why don't we, there's a very brave person, right? As difficult for you as it could possibly be, because she's in the middle, but why don't we start with her? And thank you, because the first question is always the hardest to get. Better be good.
Making me nervous. There were two things that you didn't mention, and one was fish and how we can keep it sustainable, and the other one was non-sugar sweeteners.
Oh, well, let me take the second one first because I don't have a clue. You know, I'll confess to drinking Diet Coke. But I think the jury is out on those things. I don't think anyone really knows. And I would not use a lot of them. But I will confess to ignorance on that. Fish I know a lot more about. Sadly, I don't have any better answers, but I know a lot more about it. There are fish management techniques that seem to work. So the cod population, for example, is coming back. But what has to happen for us to be able to continue to eat fish is that it's going to become much more expensive. Now, this is going to happen to meat in the long run also, because another thing I didn't talk about, which someone will ask me about if we have enough time, but another thing I didn't talk about is raising meat sustainably, which can be done, but it means it's going to be much more expensive and it means we're going to eat much less of it. This is where fish is at now. If you want to eat fish and have it be sustainable, you've got to be willing to pay more for it, and you've got to be willing to see it as a treat. Farm-raised fish is another story, and it could be that farm-raised fish makes it so that we can eat more fish again. But right now, I don't eat much farm-raised fish because I'm really, really down on the techniques that are being used to raise it. So that's the best I can do in the fish department without an hour. Sir?
I was just wondering what your thought was about the food-obsessed cultures. I'm thinking of France and Singapore, places where people they chase each other around to eat. Do you think that they have a better balance than we do? Maybe the goal is to be more food-obsessed.
I don't have much experience in Singapore, but I spent a lot of time in France, and I'm amazed at how much dessert they eat. I really am. I'm staggered, and I have to think that they've discovered some benefits in cigarettes, and it's a very strange place. No, I mean, I think, I think the secret, if there is one in France, is eating socially, is cooking, is eating slowly, is eating with each other, and they don't eat huge portions. Singapore, I don't know much about. I was there once, and when I was there, I was food obsessed. So, well, make it easy for you.
How does wine or even alcoholic beverages in general fit into your dietary regimen?
I got to tell you that I got that question last week. I'm going to answer it. But this was so funny because I got that question last week, and I answered it. And the next guy who asked me a question said, how come you talk about wine and beer and you don't talk about other mind-altering substances? And the guy was like 80 years old. And he'd slept through most of the talk. And I said, huh? Next question. Look, the processed food thing, there's a new tangent to my talk that's not resolved, which is why I'm being completely inarticulate. But this thing about everything coming from plants and everything that isn't a natural plant being processed into something else is very real. And you have to remember that there was a time when we didn't have too many calories, and it wasn't that long ago, when humans struggled to get enough calories, when people died from not getting enough calories. Now there are more people in the world that are dying from overnourishment than undernourishment. But back in the day, you took a bountiful harvest and you said, holy crap, well, what are we going to do with this stuff? With so much of it, it's going to rot before we get to eat it. So you fed it to animals and converted it to meat, or you pickled it and preserved it in other ways, or you made alcoholic beverages. You let it ferment in a controlled way, and you made beer and ale in Anglo-Saxon countries, and you made wine in France and Southern Europe in general, and you made vodka in Northern Europe. And all of these things were for really, really hardworking people, which our ancestors were. And I don't mean to imply that we don't work hard, but we do sit on our butts. There's actually three people standing in this room right now. For really, really hardworking people, getting any form of calories was an important thing to do. And you could actually drink vodka as a form of nourishment, and drink beer as a form of nourishment, because what you needed was carbs in a concentrated form. Now, we are obviously so far from that, and we're not going back. We're not going to become farmhands, most of us. So what is the proper role of beer and wine and other beverages in a sound diet? You drink as much as you want to. What else is the proper role? You drink as much as makes sense. I mean, it's an individual. Is there no one on this side of the room? Are we speaking a different language? This is the Italian. Everybody over here is speaking Italian. There's some people back there. You take your pick.
I just wondered if you know of any place in the country that has succeeded in passing a soda tax.
No, I know that Philly and New York came as close as any place. The leading cities are Philly, New York, and San Francisco. And whether it's in one of those three cities or somewhere else, I fully believe that it's going to happen because it makes so much sense. But no, it hasn't happened yet. Your choice.
I'm very interested in moving my family toward more vegan types of meals, and I do cook at home a lot. I've read your articles on using lots of fresh vegetables, grains, and legumes. But my husband claims that eating beans and legumes gives him terrible gas, and he refuses to convert over. Do you have any suggestions for?
You know, I can't. I once wanted to do a radio show where I said, I guarantee you, if I do this radio show, it's going to be, you know how click and clack. It has nothing to do with cars. So I'm not getting into marriage counseling. One becomes more tolerant of the flatulent-inducing qualities of beans as one eats them more regularly. Everyone has found this to be true. How about...
But we keep speaking of, you know, soda taxes and sugar taxes, but what about the flip side of the coin, namely the subsidies that are provided to corn manufacturers? You know, this is sort of a libertarian thing, let the price float.
Well, I certainly have argued in the past against, you know, the talk is only as long as the talk can be. But I've argued in the past against subsidies, and everybody who's kind of on this side of this issue argues against subsidies for the staple crops. One of the problems with those subsidies is that they're going, in general, they go to huge industrial farmers. So we're not even giving the subsidies to farmers we'd like to continue to farm. So, yeah, there's no argument in favor of those. You know, the stuff that I talk about crosses over into economics, obviously, and I'm not really, you know, I'm obviously not, you saw my bell curve. I mean, it's the most pathetic thing imaginable, but I'm not qualified to say, and I call friends of mine who are economists, and I say, well, what about this idea? What about that idea? And they, you know, they get into supply and demand, and they get into whether taxes really discourage the behavior you want to discourage, or whether they raise the money you want to raise, and da, da, da. The fact is, I don't know that anybody knows what's going to happen. But what's happening now is we're killing ourselves and we're strangling the planet. So we got to try something different. This is the best I can come up with. I mean, I'm the guy who's up here saying what he thinks, so this is the best I can come up with. You can think it's moronic. I can't do anything about that, but it's what I got. See, there's someone way in the back there. It's completely random.
You touched on a point that I think is very important, which is that the junk food people subsidize, they advertise. And you mentioned that we really need to advertise back. But the food pyramid isn't doing it. I'm a pediatrician, so I deal with this on a daily basis.
Right.
The food pyramid isn't doing it. What is your vision of how advertising healthy eating would look like?
Let's talk about more things that I know nothing about. You know, that Bob got, I've got emphysema billboard, we all remember, that comes up on there. Everybody remembers that thing. There were a lot of powerful images from the anti-smoking campaigns, and believe me, the anti-smoking campaigns were very effective, although not as effective as we'd like them to be. 6 trillion cigarettes are still smoked worldwide, and there are still tens of millions of smokers in the United States, so it's not a perfect situation. But I think clearly we address children, we eliminate marketing of stuff to kids, we talk about really healthy diets, not the food pyramid. You know, the food pyramid is very complicated when you compare it to my seesaw. You could imagine a pretty decent graphic being made out of my seesaw, and it's a lot simpler than the food pyramid. Eat more of this, eat less of that. It's a pretty straightforward message. So would I happily work with Madison Avenue on this campaign as an advisor? Yeah, but they haven't asked me to yet. So. There are countries.
And if so, how have they done it?
There are countries all over Europe that have really, really cut back on marketing junk to kids. They've set aside 8-hour blocks of television where there's no processed food allowed to be advertised. They've taken sodas out of schools. They've really improved school lunches. Brazil. I mean, this is what really irks me, is because we're supposed to be the world leaders. And I think... you know, sadly we're not, but it would be nice if we were, because we have the capability of being so. But I was reading a story about some poor province in Brazil where the poor kids were only getting rice and beans every day for lunch, and I thought they're probably eating better than the kids are eating in American schools, because they're eating rice and beans at least. But the government decided that in order to help local farmers and in order to have the kids eat better, the federal government mandated that 30% of school lunch, food for school lunches, had to be purchased locally, 30%. So now these kids are eating rice and beans and fresh vegetables and locally purchased meat. We're 10 years from that happening in this country. And this is, you know, I don't want to, like, pick on Michelle Obama, but this could happen. They could make this happen. And it's so far from happening, it's horrible. It's really scary. Two more questions.
Thank you. I want to ask you about your bell curve.
It's good, huh?
Quite well drawn, by the way. Better than I could do. But anyway, there was a slight uptick, you said. And we are all in this country, at least I am and everybody else I know is, hooked on these cooking shows, Iron Chef, Chopped, et cetera, et cetera. And there seems to be a growing preponderance of farmers markets in the area. And there is an awareness about food. We're all into food very much. Am I being deluded? Are we all being deluded? Are you preaching to the choir here? Is it the East Coast and maybe the West Coast that is buying into this and trying to do a better job of managing their food? Is it the whole rest of the country that's, quote, like Alabama or... And the age group, too, that's true. I was thinking of that. We are a slightly older demographic group here, maybe.
Speak for yourself. Hey, Jude. I don't think cooking shows are a particularly positive influence, and I think there's a big difference between Iron Chef and farmers markets, for example. I also can tell you that I just came back from the so-called flyover zone. I was in Pittsburgh, Denver, and Minneapolis last week, all landlocked, all urban, but very much non-coastal. And frankly, I think the people who get it are well-educated people. That's what I think. And there are well-educated people everywhere. And a guy said to me last week, and it was the closest thing I had to a kind of argument, guy said to me, well, it's all about education. And I said, okay, it's all about education. You still have to pay for education. We're not paying for education either. So if you don't want to talk about food, we don't have to talk about food. We can talk about education. How are you going to pay for that? And that's really the bottom line. If we want to get into nitty-gritty policy, which I don't think makes any sense. I mean, I spend 10 minutes talking about why we should all eat differently ourselves because, you know, we have to make some changes incrementally for ourselves, for our family, for our friends, for the people who are close to us. But if you want to talk about nitty-gritty policy stuff, let's make a school curriculum where kids, say, 8 years old, 10 years old, spend the entire year talking about food. Every subject is addressed through the lens of food. They meet farmers, they learn how to cook, they meet cooks, they do their math using little food examples. Everything is about food, and people will learn, what makes sense in this country. Okay, we have time for one more question. Where are the mics? Why don't you find someone back there and let him ask a question? I can't see that far back.
You seem to be a representative of a newer generation of public intellectuals who advocates this new thinking about food. but I think that the focus to me seems to be much more on us and our health and not so much on the animals who are being processed into the food. And that seems to me to be an important part of this equation. So what do you envision the relationship being between this kind of new responsible attitude about food and and the humane production, sustainability and humane production?
I think that we can probably eat about 10%. I think that we can probably sustainably raise and ethically raise about 10% of the amount of animal products that we're currently doing now, and I think that's what we ought to move towards. I don't think that's going to happen overnight. I don't know what else to say about that. I could say that I think that eventually we'll all be vegans, and maybe that's true, but that's not happening anytime soon. I would like to see us move in the direction of eliminating CAFOs, eliminating industrially produced meat, and producing meat sustainably, which means very little meat and very expensive meat, and eating small amounts of it. And that's the best I can do to answer that. You're a terrific audience, especially because there are so many of you. So thanks for coming.
Judy. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.